Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, June 17th, 2008 Carborough Board of Aldermen meeting. Our first item on our agenda is is Lynn Weller here? No? Is Neil McTighe here? Yeah, Neil, if you would come up and stand before the clerk. Neil is joining the Arts Committee, and he is going to be charged.
Congratulations.
Stand right there. That's perfect.
I'll just read this to you. You saw it, Neil. As an Arts Committee member, you will recommend to the Board of Aldermen a policy for the selection of art to be displayed in or on public facilities, coordinate arrangements to have artwork displayed on town property in conjunction with the staff of the Recreation and Parks Department, work collaboratively with the community on projects related to the arts. Members of the Arts Committee may assist in community fundraising activities, but any funds received by the committee or by members acting in their official capacity must be accounted for, and all expenditures by the committee must be made in accordance with the provisions of the Local Government Budget and Fiscal Control Act. Such funds may be received and expended by the town only for purposes for which the town is statutorily authorized to expend public funds, and report to the Board of Aldermen as requested, and perform such additional duties as the Board may request from time to time. And if I can get you to agree to that. Thank you. And if you would like to meet the Board, that would be great.
Thank you for your service.
We appreciate it.
Okay. Is there anyone here to speak to the board about a matter that's not on our printed agenda? All right.
Mayor.
Yes.
I think Lynn Weller may have shown up.
Oh. Lynn Weller, if you would come up and stand before the town clerk, please.
Hi.
Lynn is joining the Environmental Advisory Board.
As a member of the Environmental Advisory Board, you will advise the Board of Aldermen on policies, ordinances, and administrative procedures regarding environmental protection and the conservation of natural resources. Suggest to developers ways to utilize energy-efficient design techniques such as daylighting, siding, solar, exterior lights, and other solar energy techniques as they become economically viable. This input from the EAB is to come at the request of the Board of Aldermen or as part of a concept review procedure. Adopt a set of guiding principles or goals for the EAB and review these goals periodically to determine if they are being obtained, and take any other action authorized by the Board of Aldermen. And if I could get you to sign that, please. If you would like to meet the board.
Welcome, board.
Okay. Mr. Manager, the consent agenda.
Item 1 is approval of minutes of the previous meeting. Item 2 is a request to approve a resolution for the issuance of $2,590,000 sidewalk bond anticipation notes. Item 3 is a request to approve equipment and vehicle financing. Item 4 is a request to approve designation of fund balance for fiscal year 2007-2008 budget items not yet spent or encumbered. Item 5 is a request to set a public hearing for major modification of Phase A of 300 East Main Street conditional use permit to incorporate Phase B of the project. And that hearing would be August 26, 2008. Item 6 is award of contract for audit firm. Item 7, adoption of the Orange County Solid Waste Plan. Item 8 is a request to cancel the September 23rd public hearing. Item 9 is a request to award a contract for Fire Police Buildings re-roofing project. Item 10 is approval of performance security amounts for the Morris Grove Elementary School.
I move adoption, but I just have one question about the number 10.
Second. Okay, can we have a question about number?
In the minutes, there was one thing I wanted to point out, too.
Okay. Let's hear the question about the performance security amount for Mars Grove.
No, it's not the amount or anything like that. I was just wondering, does anyone know if the school is scheduled to open on time or is it anticipated?
Bill here from the schools and Mike, I believe part of the reason for doing this is to make sure that it will open on time. And if you guys want to say anything further,
sure. Good evening. I'm Bill Mullen. I'm the director of security for the school system. To answer your question, yes, the school is on time.
Okay. That's it. That's wrong with that.
Okay. We like those kind of reports, Bill. All right.
Don't do that every time, Bill.
correction to the minutes.
Yeah, just under update on the community garden project, it just looks like Randy's name is, it says Alderman Haven. It just doesn't say O'Donnell. Just Haven O. That's all.
You didn't catch that.
Okay. So I'll assume that's a friendly amendment to the motion.
Which will be accepted.
And second, okay. All those in favor of the consent agenda signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, matter passes unanimously. Save us lots of money by getting bond counsel out of here quickly.
Can I make one comment before we move on?
Yes.
Steve, on the re-roofing project, reading that, it occurred to me that I assume that we haven't considered any green roofing options to date for projects like that. Is that a correct assumption?
Correct.
So I just want to put the idea out that we could do so in the future. I don't want to tie it up to this immediate thing, but I think that particularly as we're looking at, you know, increased burden of treating stormwater and that sort of thing, and that it would be worth the town looking at ways to be a leader in that regard. Thanks.
Steve, I had one other question about the roofing. It seemed to be, and I was just curious how there could be such a huge difference between the bids. Is there any? It's interesting that
George has a reason or not. Sometimes bidders leave a lot of money on the table and wish they hadn't.
But it's just interesting to me that the folks who are more local were more expensive. I mean, considerably so.
They got a lot to do already. Maybe.
We certainly noticed the same thing. However, we do have three bids that were relatively competitive, and I guess in our experience, every once in a while in projects, we do get outliers, and I would assume that they are not really interested in the project, but gave us a courtesy bid.
Ah, okay. All right. We had a clear winner.
Yeah, the best number is definitely the best number. All right.
I'm ready.
Item D1.
Okay, this is an update on the provision of town services to the Northeast Annexation Area. The purpose of this item is to provide the Board of Aldermen with an update on the provision of town services over the past year to the Northeast Annexation Area as requested by the New Horizons Task Force in their final report, which was presented to the Board of Aldermen on June 19, 2007. Roy Williford, our planning director, is here to provide that report to the board. Roy.
Okay. Thank you. You have a report that's, of course, in your agenda itself, and I will try to paraphrase that with this slideshow. Again, the New Horizons Task Force did make a presentation to y'all about a year ago, and almost exactly a year ago. And this is a follow-up to their particular review. And the areas that they had concentrated on dealt with general street maintenance, police response areas, the future fire department improvements, the public transportation that would service the area, as well as the potential for the extension of an outfall sewer line. The first of all, just give you an overview of some of the neighborhoods and the streets in the area, what we consider the streets, so to speak. The streets in the annexation area, which is pretty much bordered to the south by Homestead and to the east by Rogers, and then by the northwestern or western limits of the subdivisions in the area. The different subdivisions include Camden Place here, the Highlands, Highland Meadows, Highlands North, Fox Meadow, and Meadow Run, and then properties along Rogers Road. Now, the streets within these subdivisions proper are, of course, state-maintained at this time. They have been annexed, as well as Rogers Road and Homestead Road are all state-maintained. The slide that was presented to the board during the public information meeting, this is a slide that was presented. And in that slide, once the town does accept the streets and the state turns those streets over to the town, we accept them, and they're brought up to town standard, then the town will provide for general street maintenance, which will include street name signs, traffic control signs, street paving, street right-of-way, and snow removal. To date, what has been accomplished generally includes the streets in the northeast area, again, were brought into the Carberry city limits as part of the annexation process. The streets will continue to be maintained by NCDOT until they are added to the town's street system. And the town has identified deficiencies to be corrected by NCDOT prior to the transfer to the town's street system. And this is a normal practice. Carberry continues to correspond with NCDOT officials to encourage repair and dedication to the town's street system. And again, we do continue to call our representatives and staff at NCDOT to see where they are on that. Police services was another area which was brought up by the New Horizons Task Force. And in that, this is the original report, which basically indicated that particularly the third bullet, that the department anticipates realigning the patrol areas and adding a fourth patrol district. Well, the response to that is that after considering the officer's input, the department that is, and the data information, the department concluded that adding the annexed area to Area 2, which was Service Area 2, was the best plan and that a fourth patrol area was not needed. So what they've done, the police department has actually increased the size of their patrol platoons from 5 to 6 officers. And adding an extra officer per platoon is one factor that made it unnecessary to realign the patrol areas. So we still have 3 areas, but we have the personnel necessary to take care of the situation. Fire services was another area. The particularly with the new fire department, future fire department improvements that are underway in May of 2006, going back a bit, began the search of for architectural services to design a fire substation. And then in October of 2006, architectural contract was awarded to Stewart, Cooper, and Newell, who are now working on that. December of 2006, the town entered into a 99-year lease with UNC for a 1.6-acre site off of Homestead Road. October 13th of 2007, update on the site plan, elevations, and internal floor plan for the fire station number 2, which is the same as the substation, was presented to the board, this board, who authorized a consultant to seek a land use permit and construction plan approval, which they have been doing since that time. And that as of June 2008, plans needed for these approvals are nearing completion. The continue with fire rescue services. The Board of Aldermen also added 3 anticipation of the fire station, added 3 firefighting positions to the pay plan effective May 8th of 2008, bringing the total substation firefighter positions added over the last 2 fiscal years to 9. A total of 15 or 6 additional firefighter positions will be needed to make the substation fully operational in FY10, 2010-2011. Next item was the public transportation services. This came from the original report. Mainly, this slide indicated that options associated for the cost cost options and cost estimates for potential services to the area included at that time shared ride, the peak hour fixed route system, and an all-day fixed route service and an easy rider service. To date, what has been occurring is that shared ride service continues to be made available under a three-year grant, which is going into year two, and easy rider service has also been made available. Also, Chapel Hill Transit has received approval of a grant to extend the current high school route, which has also been operating on a peak hour basis. Fixed route service to the Rogers Road for a trial one-year period projected for the fall of 09. So this will be very, very much needed, particularly by the transportation partners, to be able to gauge the demand for the service in that area. Sewer service is the last item. This is, again, is a slide that was presented at the information meeting. The proposed sewer is shown here. Now, this pink line is approximately 900 feet. That line has been constructed and is in place. The construction, it was approximately, again, 900 feet. It has been completed. And this line, traversing the UNC Homestead track, will be available for connection and extension to the property to the north, which is owned by MBI Development, LLC, which in turn will, once they extend it, will extend up to Fox Meadow and provide service to that area. Staff recommends that the Board of Aldermen adopt the attached resolution in your package, acknowledging receipt and acceptance of the Northeast Annexation Area Town Service Update Report. Any questions?
A question. Roy, do you know what kind of service or demand there is for the chair ride and easy ride in the annexation area?
No, I don't. I think it's been pretty light, as best I can say. I don't know the numbers on that.
We have here today Steve Spade, the director of Chapel Hill Transit.
Sure.
If Steve, I don't know if you'd like to.
I mean, just curious to know, make sure.
Sure.
Folks are aware of that service, which is fantastic. And they're paying for it.
Thank you for inviting me tonight. We have shared ride and easy rider service in the area, although the usage is very light on both of those services. The demand that we see and the comments that we see from the public is for requests for regular fixed route service for people to get around. And the grant is designed in such a way that we can this fall begin planning regular fixed route services based on meetings with the residents of the community and looking at demographic and travel patterns. We hope to extend then the HS route up Rogers Road as far as we can get, and then we'll have funding to actually operate the service for a year to get a better gauge of the existing demand.
Steve, could you give some background on the nature of the grant itself and, you know, what the source of funding
sure,
is?
Sure, yeah. The funding comes from a federal grant program called Job Access Reverse Commute Funding, and the program allocates funds to provide transit service. It's a competitive-based project or program where applications are submitted to the Metropolitan Planning Organization for funding. The real goal is to provide access to jobs for persons who are low or moderate income households, or develop reverse commute services that will take people from the core out to suburban jobs. And obviously, this grant is aimed at serving the low-income, moderate-income folks. It provides 50% funding, so what it's allowing us to do is to expand the service provided by the HS route, redesign the route and the services, and then we'll receive 50% funding for 1 year. At the end of that year, then it'll be up to the partners to decide if they want to continue the service. The grant is in the amount of $169,000. That was the total project cost. The grant is actually providing about $84,000 in federal funds.
Thanks, Steve.
As we work on the planning, we'll be back to the council to keep you up to date on what the planning efforts are.
Yeah, part of the reason I asked Steve to come tonight is, I mean, it's in part because I think the news of this grant is very good news for the community, and also that it was a real challenge for the transit partners to think about how to fund this service, particularly because what we think of as the Chapel Hill side of Rogers Road is not actually in Chapel Hill, and therefore Chapel Hill cannot expend funds for that service, at least initiating it. So Steve really did a great job identifying and pursuing this grant and put us in the position where we can actually initiate this service, and if it's successful, then be able to bring it into the ongoing transit system. So thank you, Steve, for that work.
Well, thank you, and Dan, I'd have to throw the thanks back to the elected officials both in Carrboro and Chapel Hill, because it was the insistence of the policy folks that they thought saw service to this area as a high priority that got us trying to think outside the box. Thanks for pointing us in the right direction.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks.
Quick question.
Yes.
Roy, just generally, what are the deficiencies of the streets that we're kind of waiting to have them transfer? Is there a generality that you can make about them? Or
George Size, I think, could probably give you the most information on that. He deals more with the road base and the integrity of the road.
The Public Works Department, when we first talked to the DOT, provided them a list of various deficiencies, and some areas needed some resurfacing, some needed some surface treatment, others needed patching and so forth. So there are a variety of things that need to be done that have all been presented to the DOT. As Roy said, we do stay in contact, and I just talked to Chuck Edwards, the district engineer, I believe, on the 9th of this month, and unfortunately he could only tell us that nothing at this point has been programmed, so that's the update that we've been given.
Well, I mean, I'm not in any hurry to get them until they're properly maintained. I mean, I wanted to know. And one more question. If at some point we had to consider some type of traffic calming or something like that with regard to future projects that are being planned for around those areas, is that something that the Carrboro, I mean, we really aren't permitted to do that until we wouldn't want to on roads that weren't
as I recall, yeah, we had a discussion about this, I think, with the New Horizons Task
right.
Force,
yeah.
And as long as they're, or until they are accepted by the town, we can't use the town's policy to pursue those types. And the state, I believe, has said no to those types of things, is my recollection.
Okay.
Do you, I mean, just so I make sure I understand this correctly, I mean, there must be, obviously there are some rural subdivisions in other areas of North Carolina outside municipal boundaries where the roads are, you know, the responsibility of the homeowners in the development, but there must be lots of rural subdivisions where the roads are public roads, and if they're not in a town, then the responsibility falls to DOT. Is that right?
Oh, that's my understanding. Yes.
And it's not just in towns. There are subdivisions in other municipalities in North Carolina that are state maintained subdivision streets.
And yeah. they just periodically get around to doing some work on them.
They do, and you know, I would encourage folks who have a particular problem with one of these streets is they really need to call DOT if it's a pothole or whatever, just like folks who live in other parts of town who live on a state-maintained street should feel comfortable in calling DOT and saying, here's the problem, can you fix it?
I was just going to ask Roy, for folks who are in the New Horizons, formerly annexed area, when can they expect that DOT might turn over the streets? Is there a window at which?
Well, I think the primary concern, and George, you can correct me if I'm wrong, is the overall priority that the state has to put forth in terms of upgrading streets in their system or in their district, and also the funding availability. They're the two main ingredients. And so, no, I can't give you a window.
We've tried to push them on a on a date that they might be able to do some of the upgrades to the streets to get them at least, not exactly to our standards. We've never said to DOT, you must meet our current standards, but we have said there's certain things that need to be done. And I think Chuck Edwards, the district engineer, is just not in a position to be able to make that kind of commitment.
Okay.
Thanks.
Questions on other matters for staff on this? All
right. Move to accept the report.
Second.
Move and second that we accept the report. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Item D2.
Item D2 is a presentation of the Carrboro Cultural Inventory Report on walking tour. Purpose of this item is to present a report to the Board of Aldermen, including an inventory of historical and cultural artifacts, buildings, and landmarks in Carrboro. These were compiled and made into a walking tour. The presentation will be given by Lindsay Davis and John Gowan, who were both students at UNC in the Masters of Public Administration program.
Good evening. Thank you for having us. My name is Lindsay Davis. This is one of my partners, John Gowan. As mentioned, we are both public administration students at UNC. Our third team member, Daryl Butts, is completing his summer internship in Rocky Mount. So although he helped us put this together, the two of us will be presenting on behalf of all of us. What I want to do is give a little bit of the history of how this came about. In the beginning of spring semester, John, Daryl, and I enrolled in two courses, public management and program evaluation and policy analysis. What you're going to see is an abridged version of our semester-long project. During the course of the semester, we were partnered with a client who became the Department of Recreation and Parks to put together an end product, which is what you're going to see part of tonight. What I'm going to do is give you a bit about the history of the project, our scope of work that we presented, the problem that we were presented with, and how it changed throughout the course of the semester. We're going to talk a little bit about the methodology as well, the information that we acquired, why we decided to acquire that information, and then what we've created. John's going to go a bit over the site selection and the tour overview, and also a bit about the development of the tour and the future that we see the tour happening to make it actually feasible. What I have up here is a bit hard to read, but this is the program action logic model. And basically, it maps what we put into it, the problem that we identified, and then how we went about creating the outcome. We can start with the problem we were presented with, which is our first meeting with the Department of Recreation and Parks, where they asked us to create a historical inventory of Carrboro that we could market to various people, various audiences. So the first thing that we decided to do was figure out what we had. There are archives. There are great photo archives and books and town residents that have been here forever that have wonderful stories. The problem is that these bits of information are very scattered. And it got a little frustrating when we saw that we didn't have any published materials that have been published since 1983. That's the most recent thing. And so much of what makes Carrboro has been created in the recent past. And that really sets it apart from Chapel Hill, and we wanted to feature that. So what we decided to do is kind of tweak our scope of work a little bit. And instead of just making it a historical inventory, is to make it a cultural and historical inventory of Carrboro and compile all of this information in one comprehensive place so that we can market it out to people. Our priority then became, what can we create to make people attractive to this thing? We wanted to take inventory of landmarks, people, places, everything that makes Carrboro what it is. So the input box is what we put into this project, what we invested in it. We took the time to take, you know, our own walking tour and figure out what buildings were still there. We looked at the existing archives. We talked to those long-term residents, and we picked out what people would want to see if they came to Carrboro. What we needed to do as far as the participation part in the output box over there is figure out who our target audience was. And this became one of the biggest challenges for us. Not only are you all our target audience in the Department of Recreation and Parks, but we also have the citizens, we have the residents, and we have people that are going to be coming into town and want to see it. What do we show them? And this was our biggest challenge because we needed something that was simple, that was coherent and comprehensive, but also something that was generalizable. And generalizability became a huge issue for us because we wanted to feature these little stories and we wanted to make the tour personable. But at the same time, we needed something that would appeal to everyone. And we ended up coming to part of a compromise with this that John's going to talk about a little later with our development. In the end, we decided that our short-term outcome would be a comprehensive listing of all of these historical sites, the buildings and the places and the meeting spaces that made the community unique. The medium term is a copy of the brochure, which we created for Carbro, which we have in front of you. You can imagine it's kind of a trifold with the map on the back. And also the long term is going to be informed citizens. It's going to be shared networks. And it's going to be a tour that can be built upon and that can involve the community in the future.
What you see on the screen now is sort of a schematic of the route that we chose. If you can imagine, on the back of the brochure that I handed out, it lists everything very similar to how you see here, except there's an addition of a route down Poplar Street. And one of the things that was a struggle for us is to figure out how to consider everything at once. Of the variables, we considered the length of the tour, how long would is it comfortable to walk around Carrboro, is it 80 degrees outside, is it 60 degrees outside, what's a good medium there. We also considered safety. We tried to keep the proposed tour on the beaten path, so to speak. We tried to use sidewalks. We tried to use areas that had protected pedestrian waterways. And we also tried to stay close to common interest. We identified three things. Certainly, there are purely historical sites that date back to the beginning of the town, such as the rail depot, sort of in the Southern Rail area. There are sites that show Carbro's transition to the future. This building, for instance, the old high school, reusing it for town administration. Things like the Carmel Mall. We wanted to show those sites. And we also wanted to show current hotspots, whether it's places like the Cat's Cradle or the Art Center that show how pervasive arts are in the community, whether it's things like the bike trails, which show certain lifestyle choices that residents may make or choose Carrboro because they have the opportunity to live a certain lifestyle. So those are things that we wanted to show all at once. If you can imagine the map here, we sort of chose the Century Center as a starting place simply because it has good access to parking lots and things. If you go up north up Greensboro Street and then come this way on, I guess it's to the west, come this way on Poplar, you get a chance to see some of the residential neighborhoods. The remains of the Mill Village, and then coming down West Main Street, continuing down to East Main, you get to see a lot of the variety, particularly in terms of locally owned stores that Carrboro has, as well as see a lot of the commercial opportunity that a visitor would have. We made a point not to indicate specific places, you know, as a recommendation on our end, but rather design a tour where people could see most of the things that generally you'd want people to see coming to Carrboro. In terms of locations, there are additional sites that are off the map. Certainly, we could probably all think of a few. But again, we were limited to the length of the tour, to the safety, to try to stick toward the common interest. And that point actually leads us to the development of the tour. We designed this so that it could be expanding. This is certainly a starting point in our eyes. The tour could be augmented or redeveloped to include, you know, things like Carrboro Day. It can be used for special events. It can be used for, other types of local history that maybe aren't included on the map. And we certainly welcome that growth and that adaptation. Again, one of the things that we thought about was using volunteer tour guides, local residents, local celebrities, local personalities that can give the tour, hit the same basic spots, but give a very personal take on the sites and the scenes of Carrboro. So in closing, for us, it certainly was a pleasure for us to work with Brendan and Anita on this project. We appreciate the board's time this evening. We'd like to open up the floor for any questions if you have them.
Do you know that in Carrboro we have slave cemeteries?
Okay.
And I'm disappointed you didn't put it there, because I think, especially now that we're about to have the first African-American president in the history of this country, that's a place that it is part of our dark history, but a very important part, and that it provokes and invites people to talk about race, which is an issue that we avoid in this country. And I think in Carrboro, there's something we're very open about it, and it's a very welcoming community and a very diverse one. And we have, right there in West Main Street, there's a former slave cemetery, and I think there's another one on near Carcourt, right?
Right.
And probably there's some more, but those are the only two that I know that I think it would be vital to have them part of people coming to Carrboro to know about that history
and
that makes Carrboro.
That illustrates not only an example of expansion, but an example of the difficulty we had being academic, so to speak. Part of the requirements for our project in finding information was to use academic research, so to speak, the books and things that were available. The sites that we chose, you know, again, wasn't an effort to exclude or to only tell a certain part of the story, but they were the ones that were verifiable by multiple sources and that could be easily obtained, you know, again, through traditional research-type methods. You know, and so we're certainly open to the fact that using different sources, particularly, you know, we'll call them local historians, you know, may have shown us other areas that would have included sites like you mentioned.
Steve, I'm wondering if Anita has been in touch with the folks at the Visitors Bureau in regard to this tour being developed. And that might be a good idea to at least pass this on to Lori and maybe have a conversation with her into whether that's something working with them that we can develop into part of the promotions they do for Carrboro.
I was also wondering, as you look back with the longer lens now, most of the work of the project is behind you. I mean, the biggest part of it, anyway, is if you got a better sense of who you'd market it to and how.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Again, something that with the question of the target audience, we worked with a lot. I think that we looked at the closest hotels to Carrboro, and there aren't any. The closest one is the Franklin Hotel on West Franklin Street. And so I think that there are so many families that come in that see Franklin Street, and they don't see Carrboro. If they do, maybe they've heard about Weaver Street Market and they want to go hear music on the lawn, or they go into Southern Village and bypass this. So I think that could definitely be a target audience, per se. I think that with the future involvement of town residents as tour guides or being involved, you know, we have, in addition to the tour that I believe is in the copy of the report that you have, although I'm not 100% certain, there's an artist addendum that features local artists and finds a way to feature the farmers market on certain days. And so it could kind of involve more of the town residents there, and hopefully word of mouth would help it spread even more.
Excellent.
Laura was here. Laura Van Zant was here, and I know we're very interested in seeing.
She'll want to be featured on it.
Right, the hotel. So there should be a hotel coming soon.
Exactly. All right, great. Well, thank you very much. This is an excellent launching point for this project, and I think
and happening in a good time too.
Yeah, that's
great.
And like
really
you say, Dan, I think we can work together with the Visitors Bureau on figuring out a way to get this out there to people who would be interested. All right.
Thank you.
Item D3, Mr. Manager.
Mayor Chilton, would the board be interested in adopting the resolution?
Oh, is there a resolution?
So moved.
Yes. Second.
All right. Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the matter passes unanimously. Thanks very much.
The next item is a revolving loan fund request from Yesh 37 Carrboro Co-working. The purpose of this item is to present to the Board of Aldermen a loan request from Brian Russell to open Carrboro Co-working and to approve a resolution authorizing the loan. And James Harris is at the podium.
Before we go on, I didn't realize we were already to this item, but before we go on, I not related to this company or this proposed business, but I represent Brian Russell on an unrelated matter as an attorney, and so I'm going to have to ask you all to...
So moved.
Excuse me. Been moved and seconded. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, matter passing unanimously. Thanks.
Yeah, right.
Okay. We have Brian Russell with us tonight, if you don't know him. The applicant is proposing to do a co-working facility in downtown Carver in the old Rigsby Henson space at 311 East Main. He's asking for $90,000 for a term of 6 years at 2% interest. He's proposing that this business will be a co-working space for professional people. It'll be designed to cater to micro-business owners, people who do freelance work, home people doing home occupations, and startup entrepreneurs and graduate students. This would not preclude anyone else who'd have a use for this type of space. He's proposing to create 9 jobs with this business, but we recognize that he'll also probably retain or create new jobs as a spinoff when these folk open up and start expanding their businesses. So Carver will be the beneficiary of those jobs as well. The security for the loan will be a second lien on his private residence. It will be all of the equipment that he'll purchase with the loan proceeds and personal signatures of himself and his wife who will be working outside the business. She won't be a part of the business. He brings $10,000 of his personal money to the business that he saved for this project. It is the intent of the applicant to share the space with the Arts Center. The Arts Center is planning to do a dance studio in the back of the building, and we're sort of waiting for them to get their stuff up to speed right now. But that's what's being proposed. He won't use the whole space. The Economic Sustainability Commission unanimously supported this project with 3 conditions. One is that the applicant shall seek pre-sale lease commitments for the business and the amount of $5,000 per month for three months. That would give him an additional $15,000 in operating funds, and he's to do that before the funds are released. The applicant shall receive all required permits and other requirements of the town prior to the money being released as well. The applicant shall secure a lease with a term of at least 6 years at 311 East Main or a comparable property, because we didn't want to tie him up. If that property does not work out, we'd like for him to have the option of seeking another site. And he has another one in mind, the Bass Knight Building on West Main. So the recommendation is that it be approved for $90,000 for a term of 6 years at 2% interest.
Just to make sure I understand, the staff recommendation is the approval of it with those 3 conditions from the commission?
That's correct.
Any questions?
Yeah, comments? I have a question. Do you know what are the 8 positions, Brian, that will be created by this?
Okay, I can ask Brian to tell you what those positions will be.
In the beginning, these positions will pertain to people helping folks that work in the space in an executive assistant type role, all kinds of things you can imagine someone would do in that capacity. Several tech support people, I imagine doing lots of support for laptops, desktops internally, and I hope to expand that outside. And I also imagine people working to drive some sort of environmentally friendly vehicle to get people from the airport to here, because a lot of my research has found that a lot of people throughout the Triangle are also very interested in this. I think it'll really support mostly people who can walk to my space, but a lot of people outside the Triangle, and I would like to help them get here as well. So I also imagine some expansion and servicing people with different kinds of conference room abilities, and there's different kinds of AV tech and other kinds of jobs that are involved around that, and anything I can do in that sense.
So. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thanks.
Any other questions? If not, I will entertain a motion for...
Move the item,
please. Second.
We move in second. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries unanimously. Thank you.
Great. Good luck.
Congratulations.
Before we move on, James, could you stay with us for a minute? I was looking over, I was glad we had the revolving loan fund summary in the packet, because I was noting the range in the loans, and that our 2 most recent ones, this one and the Neal's Deli, are at the high end of what we've loaned out, and that if we had many in that range, we'd expend all our funds on very few projects. So, James, I was wondering if you might and I don't have any thought as to what this might entail, but if you might be able to do some analysis on the loan amounts, the history of loan amounts as compared to some measure of benefit for the town, that maybe we can come up with some benchmarks on, or a trigger on, when, for just for example, if we might want to say to go over 50,000, we'd have a trigger that we'd expect certain benchmarks to be met. And I'm not saying for sure that we would be able to identify that, but I think it's worth looking at so that we understand, you know, what the significance is of loaning $90,000 as opposed to loaning 35 or 50 or 45. Does that make sense?
It does, and the main trigger would be the number of jobs that would be created, because it should be at least one position for every $10,000 that you loan. So that's the main trigger.
Okay. I, in addition to that, I guess when I looked at this, what I was wondering is how the cost of opening new businesses may have changed proportionally over time. Do you have any way of gauging that from looking at from the time that the revolving loan funds first started to now, to seeing what incrementally the costs may be to open new businesses?
I can just speak historically. The cost of construction has increased in the last 20 years. So that's one thing, the cost of goods and materials to upfit the facility also has increased. So those types of things would make them cost more money to open. But I can look for other things.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Does that make sense to you, Steve?
Yes, sir.
Thanks, James.
Okay.
All right. On to the easy stuff.
All right. Item four is the INSAPERC recommendations. On April 8, 2008, the Board of Aldermen directed staff to proceed with the evaluation of four of the INSAPERC recommendations. Staff is proceeding on those directions and offers the status report on progress to date. A resolution accepting the report is provided for the board's use, and Trish McGuire is at the podium. Trish.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Steve. I have just a few slides to share with you. So this is a background from your most recent action on the INSAPERC recommendations, which was in April. And that followed from a work session in March where you looked at, where the Board of Aldermen considered form-based zoning, some information on that, as well as specifically the recommendations of the Northern Study Area Plan Implementation Review Committee. So what I'm following up on here is that when you acted in April, you did select four of the recommendations for us to really begin honing in on, and a fifth one was folded into one of the others, so they're technically five, but sort of talking about them as four. And also, we did a little bit of follow-up research on affordable housing, our examples for some of the Belmont, some of the form-based code information we provided for you was from Belmont, North Carolina, and Huntersville, and there was a question about affordable housing in those jurisdictions. These are the recommendations verbatim from the Northern Study Area Plan Implementation Review Committee. These first two deal with looking at rezoning strategies for some particular parcels of land, and really three parcels are tracts that combine more than one parcel of land in a couple of instances. The first one is made up of two tracts of land. We have actually, in looking at this, expanded that to include several others just because of their location along Homestead Road. The second, the Hogan Ayers property, is made up of, I think, four or five parcels, and then there are a number of tracts which Omar and Adam Zinn have acquired and are hoping to develop at the intersection of Eubanks and Old NC86, and we've added just a couple of other smaller pieces in that location as well because of their making up sort of a comfortable-looking sized area. And then, so these deal with the first recommendation looks at specifically sort of VMU development and commercial development as options for these sites. And then and the second is a little bit more intensive kind of commercial examination of the parcels. And really what I have for you this evening is just an update on what we've looked at so far and some additional considerations perhaps, and you know, telling you what we're going to be doing this summer in looking at these recommendations. Oops. Sorry about that.
You're not asking for any additional correction tonight?
Not unless you have some. That's right. It's if you have some information you'd like to offer, comments, so forth. This is really a check-in. So it's kind of, is there any way to get a little bit less light? Well, you can see the big letters, so that's good. You're fine. So the Hogan tracks are here that are originally identified. We've added in these pieces as well. These parcels, all of the areas that are shaded in or outlined on the map and that are described in a little bit more detail in the report for you are either, you know, by their existing zoning, undeveloped or underdeveloped. That is, there's potential for additional development under their current zoning classification. So we have the Hogan properties as well as others that are owned by Blackwoods, Pinney's, and some other folks down here. We have this area, and this is the one that does depart from the strategy kind of outlined by the NSAPERC regarding staying on the east side of Old NT 86. This piece, this area, this big chunk of it is all within Transition Area 1. This piece up here is not, but just its location, its previous discussions, and so forth. We just wanted to make sure that the acreages were here and identified for you, and you could keep it in mind. We can stop looking at it further, but it seems like it's just in terms of the context of the Northern Study Area, it is an appropriate piece of property to still look at. You know, short of a policy statement about staying only on the east side from you all, particularly about staying on the east side of Old 86.
And of course, on that side, there is some commercial there. The mulch and stone.
There is a family right. business mulch right. and stone sales right. Exactly right on here.
Yeah.
Well, but not. If somebody asked, you know, clearly it's a family business
yeah.
there.
And we're
Bob, have you ever heard of this?
I'm shaking already.
The third piece is this piece in here, which is the owned by the Blocker family, and there's a street connection from Lake Hogan Farms to this site. It's originally the Blockers are Hogan family members of this Hogan family here that was the Lake Hogan Farms development part of the Hogan family, and so there. It is a wooded tract. I didn't go over this piece over here. The property over here does have a piece of Ballin Creek coming through it, and some selected hardwood areas. There's a fair amount of pine forest, and then very much of an open parcel in this location here.
Now, that B isn't in Carborough, right? Is it in?
It's not in the city limits.
It's not
no, the city,
but on the other side it is.
No.
Well, but
the purple line is the city limits boundary. Yeah.
But they're both in our planning jurisdiction.
Yes,
right.
Okay,
but
above
is purple.
So none of the areas.
Above C. Above C. Okay.
None of the A, B, C, D, or E are in.
None of these right. Tracks, right. These areas are within the city limits.
Okay. Correct. That's what makes it
part
of it.
Hence the
then we have the Hogan Ayers property over here, the Leek and Hogan Ayers properties over here. This is mostly wooded. Site. In terms of, I should have mentioned that these three sites or areas down here all do have access along arterial roads in town, in our jurisdiction. And in fact, the Hogan Ayers and Leek property is the exception to that kind of point from the perspective of that element of the recommendation from the NSAPERC. There is the Hogan Lake Hogan Farms Road connector is intended to. It's been approved by you all to extend up through the Legends at Lake Hogan Farms and the Ballantyne site. It is expected to proceed north in some fashion to hook up with the segment of the road that has also been approved coming down and serving the Morris Grove Elementary. So it's at some point in the future, this area, both the Twin Creeks property and the Leak and Hogan Heirs property is expected to be connected via the Lake Hogan Farms connector road. That is typically more of a residential kind of intensity road, but I think it, as we proceed further, looking at what kind of options might be available, you know, with rezoning these tracts and looking at appropriate densities, some mixed use may be appropriate there as well, since we kind of have a model for that in the Winmore development. The commercial piece of Winmore is served by the Winmore Avenue connector, collector road coming out to Homestead Road. So,
Trish, can you show where the Jones property was? There's Valentine
yes.
Jones and
yes, sure.
Jones AIS.
This is
yeah.
right here.
Right. Okay.
That's the boundary.
So it's south of Valentine.
Yes.
I always confuse those two. Okay.
Yeah.
And that also should be part of what should have connection up
yes,
to...
Yes, there is yeah. a... This is the... that's the edge
right.
of Lake Hogan Farms Road right now.
Right.
It's going to connect up through right there and pretty much right north to there. You know, there is a question with regard to the Valentine plans. They currently have shown a stub out sort of right there mm-hmm. to the east. As part of their site plan, with the northern segment of that road providing being built on the park property and providing access to the park, how that all plays out with this, you might recall that there is a Lomar and Clomar associated with it, I think, and or at least an Army Corps permit, 404 permit associated with that bridge. So the
right.
bridge crossing there and figuring out, you know, how the bridges should be spaced and so forth, mm-hmm. anything else that happens up there. Just come, you know, again, oops, going good quickly. So we have looked at five areas rather than the three that were in the recommendation. We've tried to just add those other pieces that that seem to be appropriate in light of this overall discussion about looking for other opportunities in the Northern Study Area for commercial and mixed-use developments. There is a summary in your report on the types of zoning mechanisms we have in place, specifically the conditional use zoning, as well as the general use zoning districts that might have some applicability in terms of using existing models for, you know, drafting some ordinance provisions as we go forward. And then, you know, and then a comment also about other mechanisms that might we might consider using to make sure we bring folks to the table and get, you know, as we're looking at these approaches, and have a conversation about that so that interests are spelled out at that time and maybe conflicts are avoided.
Have you had any discussions with A through E owners about what their visions are for the property?
Not, we have, that's one of our steps this summer is to sort of create a plan for how we'll do that.
Can you go back to the previous slide for the slide with the map for just a second?
Yeah.
During the committee meetings, the one of the owners from the A vicinity A, now, of course, there are actually multiple owners there, so
right.
but he was just one of them. But he did, was it Chris Hogan?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Came
yeah.
and participated in some of the committee meetings, listened in on some of them, and I think he spoke at one of James or Trish, you were there too. Correct me if I'm wrong, but he spoke and kind of described how he was interested in a mixed use type development
yes.
there of some kind. And I've also spoken with not too long ago with a member of the Blocker family who has come to a couple of our meetings and sat in the back. She's not here tonight, but and she's expressed the desire to do something similar on site C there.
And Mr. Leak, who's one of the Hogan Heirs and a resident of Area D, I have informed, I mean, I've talked with him about this this recommendation mm-hmm. and the expectation that we would have a more involved conversation moving forward.
When folk are discussing from the board or the town about mixed use, what type of mixed use are y'all discussing? Are you talking office, resident, retail? Resident, office, retail. residents? What sort of are the percentages?
Well, the bulk of the conversation, I would say, that the EnsaPerk probably had was sort of along the lines of a village mixed use. So the Southern Village, Meadowmont, the nugget of what Winmore is envisioned still to be, I think. But we still have, we have in our ordinance an office assembly zoning district, which is also a mixed-use zoning district. It does allow office, it allows retail, it allows restaurants, it allows residential uses. The references that the review that the committee did was of our village mixed use provisions, and so perhaps Mayor Chilton or James Carnahan could kind of address that more fully in terms of their view, but that's what was discussed by the committee.
If I could just to address the answer to that question, James, you wave your hand if you think I'm saying this wrong. Retail and office-type uses were more the kind of commercial uses that were discussed by the committee. Not that I don't think we were necessarily opposed to something that would fall more in the assembly category, but I think people maybe had a little bit of a hard time picturing that sort of actually being realized.
I'm going to tell you why I'm asking that question, and okay. Dan, then out. We have been talking about this for a long time, and over the summer I want the board to think more of, once they decide on a type, think about percentages. Because, mm-hmm. I've said it over and over again, we have enough residential. We just don't have enough affordable residential. That's right. A whole different issue. Right. Mm-hmm. But we certainly do not have enough commercial. And if we don't put enough commercial, because the northern area of Carver is a residential node. And they go the farthest to get to business nodes. I mean, they just do. I mean, Lydia can speak to that. They have to travel the farthest. And so if we are looking at it holistically, we want to make sure that the percentages are appropriate, not have, as in Winmore, a lot of residential and a de minimis amount of business.
Well, I was going to ask the very same question.
I'm next.
I'm going to assert
the prevalence.
Well, yeah, I was going to come. I'll just come back to that point.
Well, that's what I'm doing too. Thanks, Mark. I agree with Joel completely. And one point I want to make for Trish, or this is really a question I have, is the RTS report identified Eubanks Road as an area. Really the best area in Carborough in terms of access to the interstate for certain kinds of commercial, and that it may be when you talk about the mixed-use zone that's not residential, that for Parcel E, that might in fact be what's appropriate. And I wonder if up to this point, I have one more point I want to follow up with, but let me ask you, have you been thinking about it along those lines in terms of
not yet. I mean, that's sort of the next step is to take it to that level.
Okay, good. And then Joel, I think because I was thinking about exactly the question you were asking earlier today in terms of how much commercial, and I agree with you 100% about that we've got enough residential and that, and we had, I think, if you look at when we adopted the goal of doubling our commercial, that at that time to double it would have brought us to about 30% commercial across the town. And so it seems that the absolute minimum we would want in any kind of VMU or mixed use with residential would be 30% commercial. That would be the absolute floor, and that if possible we might want to go higher than that in terms of, because really if we're looking at achieving a town-wide goal, then 30% might not be sufficient. But it seems to me that that's kind of the lowest we should consider.
Something like that.
Well, what I was going to ask is, when Winmore was approved, if you remember what the percentage of mixed use was acceptable for that plan?
I mean, I know what the maximum that was permissible was. I at this moment, I can't say what was approved there. Because I think it was less than the maximum because right. they just because of the way the site plan worked out. But there's only a 5-acre maximum allowed, 5 acres of for commercial purposes allowed in that site, 66 acres of land, and so 10% of the site, 5 acres, whichever was less.
Right, and see, that gets to Dan's point and Joel's, because what ended up happening was what ended up being in the final plans was boutique-oriented and not really viable commercial. So I think the answer does lie in the percentage, and it lies in the kind of commercial we really want to target rather than looking at something that is boutique-oriented. Because I remember those discussions very clearly, and it was a different time, and now we're looking at properties where the heavy load of residential that's come in since that time, you know, demands very specific kinds of services.
Yeah, and I think the 5-acre minimum is a challenging limitation in the context of a village mixed use, even when it was put in place. Mm-hmm. But there was certainly a desire to really have it be kind of a locally focused commercial area. And then the village concept for Winmore initially, you know, did have another parcel of land, and there's 60 acres involved, with a more substantial commercial component kind of in their big concept for their vision for what they were going to put together. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, didn't come about. So the small piece that's at the approved development is especially small.
You know, I hate to harp on yet another thing, but that's the great being one of the older people on the board, is that this might be the time where we go to the current county commissioners and say, we want a modification of that. And because the board of commissioners that limited that 5 acres, they probably really wanted only one. And, you know, it's a criticism I've had of that board and will continue to have on that board, because I think they put Orange County behind the eight ball and Carlboro somewhat behind the eight ball. And so I think in the current environment, I think it is crucial that we go back and say that's not enough and that's not even economically viable.
I think that's a good point. I think they might be receptive to a change in it too. I wanted to throw out one other thought along these lines that I had, which is particularly with respect to, it seems to me that particularly with respect to site A on that map, and especially actually maybe particularly the property that the A is actually on there. I wonder whether we might even consider something not just to say mixed use in that vicinity, but to be even more specific and zone a portion of that A property exclusively for commercial uses. The prominent location where that property is located on Homestead Road at the intersection with Lake Hogan Farm Road. I think that's a very significant spot and very prominent spot that holds a lot of potential. And I think we ought to think about something that. You know, I don't care whether they make it mixed use. I don't care if they build any residential.
Right.
I guess
exactly.
What I'm trying to get at.
Agreed.
And perhaps we need to create a regulatory environment where where it would be relatively easy to do something commercial, particularly on the northern half or so of that parcel that's marked A there. So that's just I'm not wedded to that idea, but I wanted to put it out there on the table as something for us to think about.
But I also think if you look at it from an environmental perspective, A is, you know, field. So
it's
open
field
to be least disturbed. But of the work that the NASPERC, designating these, areas, I think each of them has promise, and I think we should pursue as much as we can with each.
And that, item two is to look at that tract for the recommendation number two, is to look specifically at that tract for a larger scale commercial, a mixed-use development but that would have a larger scale commercial development as part component as part of it. So that's kind of the so that's I'm glad to have you reiterate that point. That's kind of the sort of take we were going to use to follow up on this particular point.
Dan.
Yeah, I guess I pretty much agree with what Mark and Randy were saying, with the addition that I kind of feel like we ought to take the Site B, I don't know if you want to go back to the map so we can see it, off the table for
mm-hmm.
now.
No, and I'm not going to agree to that. You can
well,
talk
I
mean, about
well,
it,
I can tell you why. Let me tell you why, and then okay. you can disagree with all my reasons. One is that there's no services on that side of Eubank. And there's a real question about the cost and also the advisability of extending them. One is, another is that we've got part of Bolin Creek running through it, which was a big issue for us with Winmore. And I think the main reason are the final two. One is that when we embarked upon this process a year and a half ago, we agreed that we were going to maintain a population density across town. And that was a basic principle of setting up the NASAPERC process at that time that everyone who was then on the board agreed with unanimously. And I think it was Mark who pointed out last winter that if we're going to maintain that, then if we're going to increase residential zoning in some places, we have to decrease it somewhere else, and that ought to be on the west side. And the other is that I'm kind of I'm leery of doing too much too quickly. I think we have time to do A and to do C and to get those built and to let the community react to see how they serve the town and then think further. I think that if we try to do too much at once, it increases our likelihood of making mistakes that are difficult to recover from and of us foreclosing options in the future. And so in saying take that off, Joel, I'm not saying take it off forever. I'm saying that in terms of what we're considering now, let's focus on the things on the east side as the committee recommended and, you know, and then see where we are in whatever it's going to take, 5-10 years to get those built out. And I think there's also, you know, one of the points that I wasn't thinking of initially is the whole question of water supply. And when we look out closer to 2030, when the quarry comes online, then we're going to be in a position to perhaps consider some greater increases in density overall than it would be prudent to contemplate at this time. But I think, you know, coming off the drought and having such a direct awareness of the fragility, potentially, of our water supply, that we ought to be conservative, not in how much we ultimately grow, but certainly in how quickly we grow in the coming, in the short term.
I guess
so, go ahead.
My response is I'm a big believer in flexibility, and I don't want to close the door on being able to think if there's something that we could do with B. And my other comment is it's residential that sucks up a lot of water. It's really not commercial. It's residential. And so, you know, I'm going to be unabashedly honest with the board. You, unless it's affordable housing, I'm not looking to vote for it anymore. I'm really not looking to vote for any more unaffordable housing when we have a tremendous gap in commercial. And it takes us, look how long it's taken us to get to the Main Street partner thing downtown. I got on the board in 1999. When I got on the board, Harrison was 6 months old, barely moving. He will be 10. It would have taken us almost 10 years to get to the point. So to move B off the table, and I'm looking at thinking that when I am 57, hopefully I will live that long and longer, and I may not be on the board, and to think that we precluded ourselves if something flexible happened, I don't know if I can agree with that. I just don't know if I can agree with that. And so, I mean, and I'm not necessarily saying that I would assert that I want to put something retail, drive-by, shopping center on Side B. But I don't want to foreclose it if it is part of a larger plan.
I also think that if taking off B affects a couple things. First of all, with C, if you leave C on, it makes sense to leave B on because you could further concentrate commercial that could help feed into each other, and it would be close and maybe prevent more vehicular use. D, on the other hand, you can make arguments why D shouldn't be on the list because D is more or less landlocked from any major road. So that's why I think that from the work that the NASPRIG did, we should leave all of these on at this time, maybe focusing very specifically on A and C, but not mess with what is has been well thought out and considered.
Let me jump in and say I don't think we're about to make any decisions here about taking anything on or off the table like tonight.
Right.
But let me kind of shift gears in this conversation for just a minute and say and ask y'all to tell me just a tiny bit if you have some thoughts about Site E. And the reason I ask is, well, these real estate developers have gone out and bought the site, and I guess you know they're probably contemplating what they want to do with the property right now. And I haven't spoken with them particularly. They did come.
Yes, they did.
To a couple
of the
meetings.
I was going to mention that they had come as well. They came to the NSPRC meetings.
Omar
did.
Yeah, and he spoke a little bit.
Yes.
But didn't he didn't say all that much about what they were planning on doing up there. But but we'll just take notice of the fact that they've done exclusively residential developments in the, up to this time, as far as I know. I'm not aware of anything other than exclusively residential development. So I guess that the Zinn family has done, they may have, but I just may not know about it. But I guess and it's currently zoned RR, is that right?
Yes.
So it's zoned for one unit per acre. It's 21 acres or so, I think the report indicated. So it's zoned right now for 21 dwelling units. And I guess, granted, we're going to go through this planning process and so forth, but I wonder whether it wouldn't make sense to, if we really expect a very significant commercial component to be a part of their plan or that plan for that site, I guess I just think it would be helpful to hear that now so that so that they can hear that now. Or
let me say two quick things. One is, yes, I mean, I echo a lot of what folks have said about our first eye needs to be toward commercial. We all know that, and that Site E, as Dan pointed out, it's right on Eubanks Road, a major corridor out to 40, and a road that a lot of folks will be traveling down with the park and the school, et cetera, et cetera. So I would give direction along the lines myself of, yeah, commercial, and it's a great spot for it. But my question is, isn't Eubanks Road, it's going to be rerouted slightly because of the school, right? Is it going to go up slightly into that tract, or does anyone know?
I don't think so.
It just doesn't show on there. It just is very slight or something, however it's going to be rerouted?
I think there will be some change in the alignment of the intersection, but I think some of the changes they're going to make are along the Homestead, as I understand it. But I think, I mean, we haven't seen any plans that show
from Eubanks Road into Old 86?
Yes.
See,
but really it's mostly, mostly it's on 86, I believe.
Yeah,
the changes are on Old 86.
On 86,
yes.
Right.
Okay, because I was under the impression that they were actually going to be kind of moving the road somewhat.
I think there will be some movement of it to the north, but I don't think it's a gigantic. I mean, there is some alignment of the intersection that does require that, but we haven't seen a plan yet, but just, you know.
Well,
I think there's some changes. To all parts of it.
I can tell you this. I don't want to see 1 acre traveled. So that would be, you know, I'm just would not.
There's about the tracks that are shaded represent about 31 acres, and they do include, you know, some that are not part of the Zinn's property right now. But I seem to recall that Omar Zinn did, you know, indicate some willingness, and James might remember too, to something other than their traditional form for development, recognizing the board's discussions, the NSAPERC's discussions, and the the location of that property near the school, you know, near highway accesses and so forth. It seemed like there was a little bit of openness there on his part. I don't think they have not begun, you know, talking with us at all about a development, a site plan.
Is that what the board expects?
I think at a minimum the board expects more than RR.
Right.
Well, but let me put it this way. Yeah, and I bet they're hoping for something more than RR in terms of what the residential density would be. But I guess my point is, you know, we ought to be, you know, if the expectation is that there's going to be a commercial component to what they do out there, then, you know, and we haven't decided at all that 30% is going to be the magic number, but that's the number that's been thrown around here. Are we thinking that that's the kind of standard that we would hold that site to? Because that's going to be the most, it seems like well, it may be the
are
most
you saying
immediate.
70% residential.
Right.
As opposed to maybe no percent residential.
See, 70% as opposed to 100%, which is how it's zoned now.
Right, or we rezone it with no percent.
Yeah.
For commercial. I see.
Right.
That's also a
possibility. I mean, that's the way I'm leaning because mm-hmm. I
You're leaning which way? I'm sorry.
Towards what Joel was saying about upping the percentage of commercial or maybe no residential at all.
Uh-huh.
Because that's, I mean, people are clamoring for that. We've spent, what is it, a year and a half with the Nest Peak, and what for? I mean, everyone's saying this is what we need, this is what we want, and it does respond to, you know, the carbon issues of people driving all over the place. We need to put the services where people live. We don't need the rooftops.
I guess, you know, some people on the committee said, yeah, but who lives out there?
Well, a lot of people
well,
live out there.
Not on Eubanks Road, they don't. Not too many.
There's going to be a natural mm-hmm. traveling there because of the schools. Now, I'm not here to say what kind of commercial should be there, but I think it should be very seriously considered because with the schools right there, it's a natural target for residential.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that means there's going to be natural traffic going there, you know, nearly
well, you know, you have Valentine and the other ones going in and
right.
Northern Farms.
Right.
I mean, that's a lot closer to go to than where current commercial is for everyone
that's
lives
right.
out there.
But also remember that, you know, RTS wasn't talking about commercial that serves the neighborhood.
That's right.
They were talking about commercial that would want a site there because of the proximity to Carrboro and Chapel Hill and the interstate.
That's right.
Right, and so that's another thing. I mean, you know, I've said it all along. Orange County, as elected officials, we need to be looking at commercial as a whole. Not just us, because we do a really strong job of pushing it, but Orange County as well. And I'm not saying I'm for the Buckhorn Project. I'm not. But, I mean, I'm neutral. I don't have an opinion, yay or nay, because I have not read anything except what was in the paper. But I will say this. I think Orange County needs to have a better overall commercial mm-hmm. sort of focus because about 50% of our land is owned by Duke Forest, nonprofit, and the university.
And to second that, I mean, this is the last shot we have developing commercial in Carrboro. And
last five shots, it looks like, but okay.
I agree with Alderman Brown that we should not put anything off the table. I mean, I think today is just a report, and staff will continue monitoring that. And I think we should consider all areas for commercial development. And once we get more information from the staff, then we should rezone if we have to. But the message should be okay. loud and clear that we want commercial.
Okay. All right. Well, that's the level of clarity right. I wanted about that because I think one of the issues, like they did, the same developer did Claremont and Claremont 2, and there were people who made an effort to try and get a commercial component
that's
included
right.
in Claremont 2, and they felt like the developer's response, if you correct me if I'm wrong, James, but the developer's response was, it's really too late for that. We already have our plan. We don't think there's a market for
that's
it.
Exactly right.
We don't have time now to really consider that possibility. So,
but we have time
just
now.
If that's the expectation for E,
right.
I'm glad
right.
I have it laid out. Omar, are you watching?
So I'll move that we accept the report.
All right.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor, you can probably say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passes unanimously.
So I have a question for you, Joel.
Sure.
When you say that you don't want to vote for any more residential unless it's affordable residential,
mm-hmm.
I mean, is that something that we ought to talk about in terms of how and to what extent we can create a mechanism where we can actually do that. Because right now, you know, if we have residential zoning, the developers are going to come in and, except for maybe 15%,
right,
they're going to have unaffordable.
Right.
You know, and really, in my mind, the only way not to have those kind of proposals is to not have the zoning, you know, that requires them to come in, you know, under some kind of special use where they have to negotiate with us over what kind of residential they're going to build, where there's not a by right residential. And so I guess, you know, maybe this is a little beyond the discussion of these five parcels, so
right,
it ought to be included in it to some
right
extent.
I think
but
so. I think it should. I think that, you know, I think I've been quite candid with the idea that, you know, we see just a tremendous amount of, you know, enormous amount of money to live in Carrboro. And part of the reason is, what Jackie always says, is it's because it's becoming less affordable for moderately income people. One of the ways we alleviate but not reduce it is through commercial. I mean, and in some ways, if we do it right, it alleviates the pressure on the schools and some of the infrastructure, if we do it right. And so I'm not really inclined, because I know the larger your house is, the more resources you use environmentally.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've moved to that position.
Chapel Hill, around 7 or 8 years ago, they had a proposal to downzone every parcel in town above a certain size, I forget what the size was, to force developers to come in and ask for rezonings so that they would have, you know, the
more
ability
leverage
to...
More leverage.
More leverage, exactly.
Or,
and they wound up with hundreds of property owners, or at least that's what my memory mm-hmm tells me. Maybe it was only scores. Show up in the council chambers, you know, with their pitchforks.
Well, I'm not certainly thinking of downzoning what's presently here.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that can remain. What I'm saying is, what is undeveloped, we need to look at it with a different eye about what, on a whole, would sustain the community so
uh-huh
that it'll remain both economically and ethnically diverse.
Uh-huh.
And you're just not getting that. And,
yeah,
you know, I mean, I don't want to downzone anybody's property, but I put out the idea, you know, why are you thinking over the summer? We ought to give more, if you want, make it easier for people to develop what we want and make it more difficult for people to develop what we don't want.
Mm-hmm.
I think we could have a series of findings and support that decision procedurally, I hope. As I look at Bob, you know,
Bob's like, "Yeah, bro, will be back.
You'll be back next week. Yeah, oh, sure, you can do that." And those are the kinds of things I'm thinking about. You know, if there's a certain kind of commercial, maybe that should be fast tracked procedurally than a certain type of residential. You know, there could be levels. What we want the most, you get up in the front of the line first. What we want in the middle, you're second. What we really don't want, third.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a thought. Y'all
Trish,
think about it over the summer.
Do you feel like
do
some sense of this discussion can inform your work over the
I
summer
so
on this
I think
topic?
I think, yeah, definitely.
Okay.
It's very helpful. Okay. So.
Thanks.
Let's move on to a report on outside display in the WM3 district.
Well, Trish is already at the podium, and back in November, we all adopted an amendment to the land use ordinance that expanded the uses available in the WM3 zoning district and requested that staff evaluate an additional request to allow outdoor display in the zone. Trish, it's yours.
Thank you very much. So there was a text amendment adopted in November, and there was a request for additional uses. We've taken a look at the issue of outdoor display in town, provided this report for you. It's an opportunity for you to tell us if you'd like to proceed in responding to that request. Essentially, the WM3 zoning district is shown in green here. Just a little, and this again is our city limits, excuse me, our planning jurisdiction boundary out here along Highway 54, a little segment of city limits right there.
Could you refresh my memory? Is it the size of the sign or the height of the sign or?
This is about display of merchandise, essentially. Which is in the staff report, there is a table that basically shows the use classifications in the table of permissible uses, and in summary.
The issue at some level is furniture followers used to have those, like, antique lawn furniture out in front of their store out in White Cross.
Right.
And it's just a question of whether they can do that now that they're in town.
Right.
And if I read the staff report right, you would, properties on the other side of 54 right along there, because they're in a different zoning district, they would be allowed to do it right now, or they are allowed to do it.
In the B5, it's outdoor display can be permitted. It's all permitted, you know, all the uses in that zoning district are via conditional use permit. But, yes.
And B5 is what's across the street.
B5 is the zoning district across the street.
So the south side of 54 in that block between Hatch Road and Cary Road, you're allowed to do it under certain conditions.
Yeah. Well, with a conditional use permit as part of a site plan approval. And when you adopted the provisions to allow retail use in the WM3 zoning district, you going to fix that? I was afraid to push it too hard.
Yeah. George went to college.
Thank you. When you adopted that, the changes to make retail uses allowed in the WM3 zoning district, you did create a provision that for flexibility that allowed uses to go into existing buildings if there were no changes in the site with a zoning permit rather than a conditional use permit. You might recall, in the structure of the table of permissible uses, that is a departure from kind of the overall approach that's used in the watershed, which, in almost every instance in the University Lake watershed, a conditional use permit is required, even for subdividing a lot, into two lots.
You can't do that nowadays.
But this would be just a display of goods for sale.
This is a defined provision. We have a definition of outdoor display, some separate use classifications for it, and so all we've done in this report for you is to summarize what the existing regulations are with regard to, this question and some, noted some benefits and limitations, why it might be good, why it might be bad. These are kind of common questions that are raised about things like outdoor display. And then some possible additional standards are also noted, making sure we're not putting stuff out there that's going to have a big impervious surface pad that then contributes negatively to the water quality issues that we're trying to control in the University Lake watershed.
Tarps for sale.
We do have limitations on gross on square footage related back to gross floor area for as a model for the B1C and the B1G zoning district. And, of course, Weaver Street Market is an example of outdoor display in the B1C zoning district. Harris Teeter has outdoor display. Southern States, which is in the CT zoning district, has outdoor display. The PTA Thrift Shop has outdoor display. SID Surplus has outdoor display.
Recently, no less.
And so all but Southern States all those other businesses are located either in the B1C and B1G, and so there are limitations on how much stuff can be put outside.
I think it seems to me that it'd be pretty reasonable to have some way, if you're going to allow the certain kinds of retail uses, to have some reasonable regulations of some kind that would allow for outdoor display in the WM3, particularly since it's allowed right across the street.
Right.
And I guess what I don't have any particular guidance for how to or idea about how to sort of structure that or suggestion about how to structure that. But let me say, I think if we can figure out a way to do it, that's a reasonable.
Yeah.
We don't want it to turn into a junkyard out there, but a reasonable set of regulations that we get at these issues, and that doesn't necessarily. I guess the one thing, my reservation about the situation is that, so part of what you're telling me is, for example, on the south side of 54 through that block, you would have to, it'd be a whole conditional use permit process, and you would have to come before this board to get it approved and all that. And that sounds like a little more red tape than I'm hoping to apply to this particular situation.
Well, because of the way you adopted the provisions for the WM3, you know, if you all amended the table of permissible uses, added the category of retail sales with outdoor display for that zoning district, and perhaps some standards associated with limitations on square footage or whatever, you know, the sort of exception that applies, you know, you could modify that so it also would capture outdoor display as part of, you know, outdoor display isn't a separate use classification. It's a kind of overarching category for the retail uses. And
right.
So, I mean, that certainly could be done, and it would be a zoning permit for existing buildings in the WM3 that are going to be reused for that purpose.
So if that's what the board wanted to do, I think what we would need, correct me if I'm wrong, staff, would be just a motion directing the staff to develop such a proposal. And
right.
So moved.
Second.
All right. Been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously.
Are we done?
We are done. Is there a motion to adjourn?
No,
wait, I beg your pardon. We are not done. We have one matter from one of the board members.
Okay.
Yes, if I may indulge your attention for a second, and I will ask you for your support. And I think some of the people have wrote this before. This weekend I was reminded as I was cutting the lawn that we really need a good neighbor pooper-scooper ordinance in the town of Carborough. As I step on a very smelly, stinky stuff, and my child playing in the ground when I was cutting the ground, and I love dogs, I love animals, but I don't love to step on their poop. And I don't think nobody does enjoys that. We really need to have a good neighbor's pooper-scooper ordinance.
We have a memo on that at our place tonight. Did you see that?
From Chief Hutchison.
Timing is everything.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's coming up.
Part of there's a report on it. It's up to you all, and there's some information in there from Chief Hutchison about the with concerns about the ability to enforce such an ordinance, and anecdotal experiences from another jurisdiction.
I mean, I understand that, and it's
sounds
more
like John's got some anecdotal experiences.
It is. I understand the enforcement issue. I mean, there are laws that, you know, no laws we know get enforced, but I think it's about educating people, you know. And I think if we have the ordinance in the book, it's like the dog leash. We can't enforce that, but you know that people get in trouble if you get caught, you know, with your dog without the leash.
That's
and
cool.
I think it deserves the same level of attention.
You know, when I think it was David brought it before the board a couple of years ago, and one of the things that I know that we can institute around downtown anyway is putting up the dispensers, the plastic bag dispensers, and that's part of the education piece so that folks know when they're walking their dog, they're expected to either bring a bag or pick up a bag. And actually, out in the Carolina North in Bowling Creek, they've put a really nice setup that is being used pretty well, I'd say, out there. But I know the town of Chapel Hill uses it, and at least it starts to get people thinking that the expectation is that you're going to bag what, you know, your animal is eliminating, and you're going to be responsible for, you know, putting it in the garbage pail. So, if nothing else, even though I know that it's really hard to monitor, I know that that's one thing that we can do proactively.
No, but see, the good thing about it is if you have an ordinance, and I'll just give you an analogous, and then because I want to leave too, so I'll be quick. We have a leash law, and if you're like me who has a dog who gets along with no other dogs, and someone has a dog off their leash, you can say, hey, there's a leash ordinance. You need to put your dog on a leash. Mm-hmm. Because if my dog beats up your dog who is on a leash, I'm not paying the vet bills. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the same. While it's not enforced, there's a level of your dog needs to be on a leash because that's a violation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not me.
Right.
It's the rule.
Right.
You surface.
But I'm not disagreeing with an ordinance. What I'm saying is that one of the things that really motivates people to action is when they have something right there.
Right.
And you can put it on the books, but it's another thing to make it available for people to change behaviors.
So the language that Mike has in this 2006 memo, we would need a town code amendment
on the back.
To do that.
Right.
Yes.
So, John, do you want to propose that we have that town code amendment?
Yes, big time.
Okay, I'll second that.
I move so.
All right. Been moved and seconded that we ask staff to bring forward a code amendment addressing this issue. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And
most
careful walking in the meantime. is there a motion to adjourn? Yes. Moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Matter passed unanimously. Later.